You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this edition of the Made of Clay Report is George Ferrari.
Good morning, Eric.
Good morning, George. It's good to have you here.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
So George, the way we start the show is, the show's about getting to know each other and to model some of the kinds of conversations we could have if we were to just ask each other, who are you on the street? Right. And I know we don't do that because it's not polite, but at the same time, it's part of our isolation as
a
culture.
Yes.
So who are you, George?
Who am I? I'm lots of different things at lots of different times. I certainly identify as someone from upstate New York. I grew up in the Southern Tier in sort of rural Broome County. I've lived in Ithaca since 1980, so I identify myself as an Ithacan as well. I think those are two different identities, and sometimes people don't understand that from Ithaca.
No, they don't.
Yeah.
I mean, we're construction with counties.
And people say things like, well, you didn't leave far from home. Well, geographically, no. Socially, culturally, politically, spiritually, in the firmest sense of that word, Broome County still has a sense of surrender, despair, kind of willingness to let things go. Whereas what I'm attracted to in many ways, and why I identify myself as an Ithacan as well, is this idea that we don't settle for the status quo. We are very socially entrepreneurial. We're kind of not ready to say, oh, that's the way things are. That's the way we'll let things be. And I find that a very intriguing place to be. I get energized by that. So that's part of who I am as well, being part of this ongoing yearning, searching, holding two ideas in our head at the same time. You know, this is a wonderful, great place, and yet we have work to do. And I want to be part of that work. That's part of who I am.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very much
So where does this play itself out?
I think it plays itself out in all aspects of my life, in my home life, in my work life, in my faith community life. Part of who I am is a Catholic, and that's really important that people understand and respect that. Sometimes that does not happen in this area. And, you know, Catholics are a big, messy group of people that don't get along really well.
There may be one pope, but there's not one way to be a Catholic.
There are multiple ways, right? So, you know, I'm very much of the age, I'll be 55 soon, I'm very much of the age of sort of the post-Vatican II Catholic, about the promise and the potential and the reforms that came out of that movement about engaging the laity in a faith community and having responsibility and not being passive, but being very active and very engaged, very much from a Jesuit tradition of questioning things, of, you know, the divine gave us a brain. There's an expectation we should use it and not be afraid of where it goes, right?
Just don't dust it up.
Exactly. So that's part of who I am, sort of like the Catholic social worker tradition of finding places in which society fails us and rebuilding society such that it addresses the needs that we have to respect the inherent dignity of every person. And that systems should be serving people. People shouldn't be serving systems. So that's very much who I am. At the same time, I'm very much have constructed my identity around being a gay man and what that means in our society, and having lived through the periods of time I have as a gay man, certainly having experienced the AIDS, HIV crisis as it changed over multiple decades now, that is a central feature to who I am and how I respond to other people who identify as such and people who don't, and people who want to pigeonhole that or define that or reduce that to one set of views or positions. I think it's really important to be the designers of our own life. I think that's very much who I am, is that we have a responsibility and a great joy and an obligation to be engaged in how we design our lives, and we should never give that up.
Right.
Lots there.
To pick up. And you brought some music with you, and you wanted to, I mean, what's really funny is after this introduction, the music sounds even more appropriate.
Oh, good. Wasn't necessarily planned that way, but great.
So this is the theme for Mission Impossible,
right?
In the 60s, and there is this kind of, it's Mission Impossible, but they always seem to manage to get it done in the
pretty much
of 60 minutes.
Pretty much, yeah.
With commercials. And there's this quality of optimism, too, that you have you're going to tackle a bigger problem, and you're just going to keep coming back at it, you know.
Right, and you're going to do it as a group. You're going to do it as a team that's responsible to each other.
Right. Which is the spiritual piece. Yeah. Yeah. Here we go. listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this edition is George Ferrari. So, George, you didn't move far, but you moved significantly.
And, yes.
In that same vein or spirit, what were some of the experiences that you've had that have kind of led you to move here, that
right.
have kept you here, and how is it that you've come to know the life that you value, that you,
right.
you know, how is it that you've come to shape this life?
Well, I came here, as many people come to our community, to attend college. And I should say that I'm the second person in my family ever go to college. I'm the first to ever leave home to go to college. My father stayed at home while he attended St. John's University in Queens. My brother and I did not grow up in Queens. We grew up in Binghamton, as I mentioned, mm-hmm. sort of outside of the city of Binghamton. And it was very important for me to define myself separately from my family. So the classic late adolescence developmental task. And I'm actually a junior. My father's deceased, but I'm a junior. I grew up being called Little George, and somewhat right. the shadow of my father in many ways. We shared some things in terms of personality together. We're both he was and I am a sort of raging off the charts extrovert. We like people. But that's about where the similarity ended. And it was really important for me to find my own way separate from. And that was a bit of a conflict and stress in our family. And my mother was very much for that. My father was very much not for that. So I remember very, very distinctly conversations in our household when it was time for me to look about what happens after high school, and it was definitely mm-hmm. going to be college, but where and how that was going to happen was very much up for vociferous debate in our house. And I was fortunate enough where I had the support of my mother to look at going somewhere outside of our home community. And it just so happened that I was attracted to Cornell University. Now, what some people may not know is that my first year experience was miserable. It was just absolutely terrible. It was an awful mismatch.
As it is for many people.
Yeah. And that in some ways made me who I am. It was the first time that I experienced, you know, abject failure academically. It was a question of who was I going to be. I was accepted into a different college than the one from which I graduated. I was supposed to be an engineer, and it was really clear at the end of the first year that was not going to happen.
Right.
And it was a real soul-searching time about how do I find my path? Do I even come back to this particular town, this particular university? And there were lots of people at the university who helped me find the right path into what wound up being human ecology.
Uh-huh.
Very different than engineering.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and that was a place where I began to look at my abilities and my interests, my curiosity about people, about groups, about communities, about the ways in which we can treat each other better and the way that we can help each other heal through some of the challenges we have. Very different than what you would hear from an engineering student, right? In terms of in the late 70s, early 80s, what got one into engineering. That kind of an essay would not have probably gotten me into engineering.
Right, right. Although, yeah. And what's really funny is that now with the
yes.
programs in engineering, and Tony Ingraffia ran a group that worked out of the human relations schools, people
yeah.
from the northern Scandinavian countries when he was doing it, but that would not have been part
it's
of
different
your experience.
It's yeah. different now. It's different now. Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah. So what did you have to learn about yourself in order to buck your father?
Yeah.
And in order to also buck the judgment that you had of yourself for having failed,
mm-hmm.
How did you have to reframe yourself to make that transition?
I think, number one, that it was okay to fail. It wasn't cataclysmic, even when it felt cataclysmic.
Or it is cataclysmic, but you still
survive. It is cataclysmic, and you still survive. That's a better way to say it, absolutely. and that there was more than what I knew, and that I shouldn't be afraid of what I didn't know.
Yeah.
In terms of possibility, and that there was an opportunity to explore. So I would say part of who I am is being, I wouldn't say reckless, but somewhat fearless to the point where I'm willing to try things out well before I know exactly how they're going to resolve themselves or end. I'm the sort of person that says, oh, let's see what happens if we do this.
Right.
I wasn't that sort of person before.
Right, right. And how have you learned to use that skill? Because that skill is really important, but it's really scary to people around you, especially
it can be
especially
very
teams when you're bringing other people along with you.
It can be very scary, and recognizing that it can be very scary, number one, being responsible for what happens. Mm-hmm. Number two, being willing not to necessarily go whole hog down a road when it's clear that it's not the right road to go down. You know,
looking know how for, to stop.
Looking for initial, to know how to stop, but even before that, looking for initial data, responses, feedback that says, this may not be such a good idea. It can be modified in that kind of way, right? So that's why I say it's not reckless, but it is adventuresome,
you know?
I find it's very stimulating. It helps me create new ideas, and I understand that not everyone approaches things that way, and I don't expect everyone to approach things that way.
You know, there's a difference between being a thrill seeker and being an adventurer who wants, who's really kind of testing the limits.
Right. And I think part of being an adventurer is being responsible for whatever mess results from the adventure.
Yeah.
You know, to do the repair and the cleanup from that as well.
Right. So how did you migrate, what did you end up majoring in human ecology, and how did you migrate then?
I remember a woman very distinctly in 1981 at Cornell University. It was part of a sort of testing and assessment office. It was part of the career office. And, when it wasn't going so well, part of what was recommended is I go through some, things that helped understand better what my aptitude and personality type was on that sort of thing. And she came to the interview with me with a stack of papers of the results of the exams that I took, the assessments I took. And she slammed them down on the table. She said, "What the bleep were you doing in engineering? We've totally messed up. We've got a place for you. It's called human ecology. You're going to be very, very happy there." And I wound up majoring in what was then called human development and family studies. Mm-hmm, sort of a mishmash at that point, a little more interdisciplinary at that point with things like cultural anthropology and women's studies and sociology and psychology and developmental sociology. And really interesting to me about, I'm curious about people. I'm always curious about people. I always have been. And that just felt right. Mm-hmm. And it was a place I was able to connect the questions I had with the ability to apply knowledge. I really like the applicability of those classes and those opportunities. I remember very distinctly, I did a field study in my senior year, and I was in the community for 20 hours a week. And it was really, really very valuable for me because I was able to be part of a team then, the first team in a not-for-profit sector. I worked at suicide prevention. I learned under an incredible leader at that point, Nina Miller, who's the executive director, and an incredible staff. And I thought, oh, this is what I can do with this information. This is I could see myself doing this kind of work. Mm-hmm. And I have ever since.
Yeah. It's... I'm responding to your story, and I'm not thinking about the next question. So, which is a kind of a failure on my job. That also set up a relationship for you because Nina was a mentor.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And that's a big part of, especially in this community, being able to forge a career that actually has a trajectory rather than a lot of ad hocery.
Yes. Little ricochet rebounding around. My career has very much had a trajectory. And Nina has been and continues to be a mentor for a lot of people in a lot of different ways. She often helped individuals enter the mental health field, and that was something I thought about for a while. But I really liked what I saw the potential was to manage an organization, a not-for-profit, to be I think when you're the executive director, the CEO of a not-for-profit, your most important job is to maintain the vision of the organization, the mission of what the organization does, and help people locate themselves within that mission. And you're not holding it so tightly that it's brittle and never changes, but you're also not allowing it to be so amorphous that people don't understand what it is over time. And you're inviting people to find their place within that mission as you move forward to achieve what's going on.
You've effectively described the role of a pastor in a large congregation.
Yeah, I think that is probably very similar. You would know that, right? Yeah.
A priest, yeah. I mean, that's exactly the where people are well matched is they are working on stuff that matters to them that's a little bit beyond their comfort zone.
Stretching a little.
Yeah. And but it's not so far beyond that they shut down or that they become ashamed when they fail.
Right.
They don't become ashamed at the failure, but they learn from it.
Right. And they help to move themselves forward and see ways that they can contribute over time to the overall purpose of the organization. I like to build institutions in the best sense of the word institution, not in terms of an opaque, exclusionary, concrete, never-changing organization, but as a tool that the community has a moral claim to that is bigger than any one individual that helps us achieve certain goals in what we're doing in our community. And I find it very exciting to be able to do that.
Right. And I want to play... You're the first person who's actually initiated a conversation about institutions per se.
Uh-huh.
We got a little bit there on an interview I did with David Kay and Aloja Arwele a week or so ago. Institutions make our actions predictable to others so we can work in concert. And we can change those agreements.
Right.
Because they're under our they're our choices, and sometimes we can defy them to show people things they hadn't seen yet.
That's right.
But that defiance is still an act of honoring the institution.
It's still connected to the absolutely.
Yeah. And it's not about bricks and mortar. And
no.
It's not about being rule bound.
That's right.
And that's how it's often the displacement from the true institution, and then getting stuck in rules or stuck in brick and mortar stuff. And so much of our thinking about government or human rights or all this stuff is stuck in rule-bound institutions rather than how we have to roll with times as they change.
Yeah. Rules get a bad rep. I mean, I think in some ways, rules can be good if they help us be able to predict what's going to happen and help us feel safe. But rules are only a tool.
And we know that we can negotiate how to change them if they really prove to be.
Exactly. And tools need to be assessed. And are tools doing the job it should be doing, or are they doing a different job? If they're doing a different job, you need a different tool.
Right. I recently just talked with a couple of anthropologists, and they're secular anthropologists.
Mm-hmm.
I both wrote my undergraduate thesis with one of them, and but also went to seminary, and I was more interested in anthropology than theology in seminary. Uh-huh. And anthropology is how we work within our human limits,
right?
And
right.
how we understand what's possible, realizing that we don't fully understand or fully control.
That's right.
And you don't have to believe in God to understand that we don't fully understand or fully control.
That's very true. That's very true.
So it becomes a very practical way, which is at the heart of secular anthropology.
Uh-huh.
But we often don't think of working together in that very in that kind of negotiated way.
We can't afford to define anyone as expendable in any of the work that we do, ever. We need everyone to do this.
And what's scary about these times is that each the extremes are in some sense writing the other side off.
Yeah. The opportunity in
is
these
enormous,
times
is enormous.
Is enormous, and that's another element of who I am. I am a annoying optimist. You know, I'm not only the glass half full. We have a whole set of glasses, and they're all full. Look at that! Look at this great opportunity.
Right. And it's just a matter of our tackling them or taking them on and drinking from them. Let's see. Where are we now in the time? Let's cut to a piece of music you brought. Okay. Quite a bit of music. What would you like to play next?
Let's go to the Sondheim piece. Stephen Sondheim's been a really important person in my life in terms of his artistic work. And this is from a wonderful musical called Into the Woods.
Yes, and you will recognize this.
Mother cannot guide you. Now you're on your own. Only me beside you, still you're not alone. No one is alone, truly no one is alone.
I wish, I know.
Right things.
Who knows what she'd say?
Who can say what's true?
Nothing's quite so clear now.
Do things, fight things.
Feel you've lost your way.
You decide, but you are not alone.
Believe me, no one is alone.
No one is alone, believe me.
Truly,
people make mistakes. Fathers,
mothers,
people make mistakes. Holding to their own.
mistakes.
For their mistakes.
Everybody makes
one another's terrible mistakes. Witches can be right. Giants can be good. You decide what's right. You decide what's good.
Just remember.
Just remember. Someone is on your side. Our side. Someone else is not. While we're seeing our side, maybe we forgot. They are not alone. No one is alone. Someone is on your side. No one is
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is George Ferrari. So, George, I just want to highlight one thing as we pick up the conversation again. You are maybe the second or third man who has been willing to openly identify as gay from the beginning of the show.
Uh-huh.
And that's it surprised me because I've had several guests who for whom that has not been possible.
Yeah.
And so what is your experience locally that makes you comfortable?
Boy, we can do a whole series on this question of what it's like to be a gay man in Ithaca.
Well, we could go for 20 to 30 hours on that time. In fact, you could have your own radio show on that time.
Might be very interesting. I'm enjoying that. It's a very, very complicated set of questions and considerations. I'm of a certain age, as I said, I'll be 55 soon, where I make a distinction between being gay and being identified as homosexual. Homosexual, in my mind, is sort of a clinical diagnostic term. It comes from a medical-based model. Gay, for me, claims my right to socially construct an identity.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it is a central feature of who I am. It is a way of saying, no, there is another way to relate to the world. There is, if we break this social taboo, then we have the opportunity and the invitation to question every social mm-hmm. taboo. Mm-hmm. So I find it very liberating in that kind of way. And I'm still of the age where I think of gay pride marches, not gay pride parades. Okay.
Right.
And I also lived through, as many people here have, the sort of the ongoing issue of AIDS and HIV, which has not gone away in any kind of way. It just has morphed and changed. So part of why I think a lot of gay men in this community don't feel safe is that this claims to be a safe place, but it isn't. So I'll give you an example. My lover and I do use that term because I don't use the word partner for a mm-hmm. political reason, because I think it's important to underline that for me, my identity as a gay man is about love. It's not about a social contract. It could include that now that we have marriage equality. But my lover and I, Daniel, were walking down the commons 2 or 3 years ago, holding hands during Oktoberfest, and someone took the extra effort to leave a business on the commons that he was eating at, a restaurant, and scream at the two of us, all fags should be hung to die. You need to die. Well, this person didn't realize he did it to the wrong person. So I, of course, turned on my heels, went over to him, started wagging my finger in his face. I told him he needed to be quiet. He needed to not say that to anyone else. He needed to go back inside, mm-hmm. and he needed to think about what he did.
Right.
He was shocked that anyone would challenge him in right. that kind of way. Right. This was during a festival. There were people all over the place. No one else said a word. We then continued walking. We were walking over to the Cascadilla Gorge to have a walk. And we were walking down, and the woman in front of me turned to me and very sheepishly kind of looked at me and sort of did this head cocked kind of thing and said, well, that was really messed up. And then I said to her, yes, it was. And you know it was.
Yeah.
And the next time that happens, you have a responsibility to say something, whether it happens to a gay man, she happened to be a white woman, whether it happened to a man of color, a family that, you know. So I think it's really important to think that our community is not necessarily as safe a space or as allied a space as it could be. There's things that change with that. But We're not a major metropolitan area. We don't have a critical mass of gay men here. I couldn't find an out gay male doctor if I wanted to. There's no longer a gay bar. There are not a lot of social outlets. Now, someone might say we're past the needs for that. I would argue that we still have needs for those sort of opportunities. So,
well, I mean, we're an odd place because in terms of population who are gay, lesbian identified,
right,
we're second only to Manhattan in terms of percentage of the population here who are gay or lesbian identified. But it's different.
Well, it's different, and I also think it's a mistake to always link those two together.
Yeah,
and sometimes we get lost in the alphabet soup of LGBTQI. There are parallels. There are places where our needs and concerns intersect, and then there are some really important places where they diverge.
And this is why we're talking about
this. Is why we're talking about that. Right. So, you know, I can talk about this for a very long time, but I do think there's an opportunity to, this is a place where Ithaca claims certain things that are aspirational, that are not yet true. I think we can get there, but part of who I am as a sort of highly verbal, pathologically extroverted, assertive, stubborn Italian American. I'm going to claim my Taurus. That's another identity. I'm going to claim my space, and I'm going to dig my heels in, and I'm going to dare you to move me, and you will not be able to move me.
Right. And not wanting to move you, but to engage you.
Yeah. Well, definitely.
This is yeah. One of the things. You know, we're an awkward community because we are open and allied within certain limits, but we have a hard time with religious conservatism, which may or may not be hateful.
Yep.
We have a hard time with the notion that some groups need to do work among themselves in a way that they can't do with outsiders, and that can be across cultural, racial,
right,
religious, whatever. And,
absolutely.
And it's fine at the same time, but it's also a question. So when I'm with people who are extremely anti-gay or lesbian,
mm-hmm,
I tell them the story of the congregation that I grew up in,
mm-hmm,
where there was a woman who was the postmistress in the town in 1915 and had that role until maybe 1925 when she went back to lawyering. And then she was the mayor in 1930, and she lived her whole life with a woman. And
mm-hmm,
and there was a man in the congregation who was a superintendent of schools of a neighboring district, and he lived his whole life with a farmer. And they were members of the congregation that I grew up in, and nobody
right
challenged them, but they were born in the 1880s and 90s,
yep,
and they were of a generation that didn't, you know, that accepted without a lot of chatter.
Right, or challenge.
Or
right,
challenge,
right,
because
right
they could accept that people were fundamentally different. And
yeah,
the men would even hold hands in worship.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not, they didn't get taken to task for it.
No.
But people would have taken younger men to task for that in the 50s and 60s because we became more homophobic.
Well, I also think it's a challenge it's about power and control. Like, you know,
yeah,
most people can figure out often, not always, who is gay. It's when I claim my identity in a public space and I hold a hand of my lover, or I say that I'm gay, that's when the challenge comes. When I say that I'm going to be the author or designer of my own life, you don't get to define who I am. And that's the issue for me, is that we have a responsibility and obligation, and there's great joy that comes from living life fully in charge of our own life.
Right. And what I want to slide this into is that we didn't have such, in many communities, we didn't have such fixed rules about gender or orientation. And that became part of American consumerism, with a focus on particularly a control of women and women's bodies, but
mm-hmm,
also a control of what it meant to be masculine.
That's right.
And so we have suffered from having these rules and these institutions in our heads, which are crippling.
Mm-hmm.
And when you bring people into that conversation and show them that there have been other ways to be,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm,
the religious tradition that I grew up in has a certain quality of Christian anarchism, which is you don't go along with something you can't consent to. It's
mm-hmm
your moral obligation to dissent until you can willingly, freely consent.
Mm-hmm.
And the point is to consent, not to remain, you know, kind of a religious, I mean, a belligerent dissenter,
right,
but to
right
be constantly looking for ways you can consent so that the whole, everybody gets included.
To find the points of agreement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also to know where you can't agree, but you create a space for others that is safe.
And there's a whole separate universe around the civic space, right? So that's the religious space we're talking about. Right. But then there's a civic space and how laws and the practices of those laws are informed or controlled by the more religious space. And that's where you get into a real messy, muddled kind of place. So you can have whatever belief you want to have in your spiritual space, whether you are working on that belief or trying to find points of agreement or not. But if you refuse to believe that I have the right to exist and you manifest that in the civic space, that's when we're going to have trouble.
Right, right. And the ability to, it went from beyond harassing around laws against homosexual behavior or bars or whatever, to denying the right to exist in the aftermath of the first real success of gay rights, which was in the very early 1970s when some really positive stuff happened. And then the backlash hit. And that's when the denial of the right to, from my point of view. So my community that I grew up in rural Midwest, people were open to this. It was not a big issue. It became a big issue as it became a part of the culture wars.
It became very, and let's never forget that we lost the most radical, envelope pushing, risk taking leaders in the gay male community because of the plague.
So those,
if not for AIDS and HIV, where would we be? I always ask myself that question. And I don't know the answer to it. But I think we need to understand there is an entire generation of conceptual and activist leaders that we have lost.
Right. And people with profound varieties of ways of relating. I began doing work with persons with HIV/AIDS across the cultural and political spectrum in 1984, in New York City. And in that time, there were so many different, I mean, the fear was kicking in, but there were still so many people who had different ways of being out or not out, being present to others, being in relationship. But a lot of that got, a lot of that nuance, a lot of that subtlety got lost in the crisis.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's been stripped away.
In the horror. So let me just do the station ID here because we're at the time in the hour. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is George Ferrari. So, George, what would you say would make it, what would make your experience and I'm assuming that you have relationships with other men and you're talking about how it is to be gay and out in Ithaca or no?
Somewhat, and you know, we all don't agree.
Yeah, no, that's exactly, and that's what a lot of people don't get.
Right. Give me a microphone, and I'm not saying you're doing this, but other people have said, you know, what are all gay men? Well, let's see. Last time we had our Congress, and in our newsletter, we all voted on this, and this is the one position we all have, right? I don't know. I think there's huge generational issues.
That's what I was going to say. I mean.
So it's
their personality and culture.
There's
issues.
Not a much talk about this. Right. There's all the sort of intersectionality kind of things. I would like to talk more about it. I don't feel like we're talking a lot about it.
Yeah. And it needs to be a conversation among people who have a vested interest in it and not necessarily you and me. And
informed by lived experience. Absolutely.
How have you had to change? How have you had to change as a person in ways that you would not have predicted or necessarily even have chosen in order to be up to live the life that you've come to value?
Oh boy, that's a huge question, which I think is your job to ask the huge questions, right?
How have you had to change in ways that you wouldn't have anticipated?
I've gotten more decisive. I used to be a little more... I need more information before I can make a decision, or I'm not as ready to settle on something. I certainly have.
Why have you gotten more decisive?
I think some of it is my career and being in positions of leadership in organizations where things need to get done. And I've gotten more confident in my decisions. I've also gotten less, I would say, less brittle and more open to other people engaging in more of those conversations and decision making. I think I've focused a lot more on how we can work together to achieve a goal rather than working separately within our own individual silos. I really focus on team building and not building silos. I think it's really important. So those are some ways.
What you've described is kind of this, to be decisive as a young person, I think, is to be somewhat brittle.
Yeah.
And you come off as domineering sometimes, being decisive.
Yeah.
And to be decisive is you really doing people the favor of giving them something to react to, if you understand when you're decisive that this is the opening volley and not where we're going to end up. But the decisiveness gives people a chance to engage.
Yeah, yeah, I think it does. And it's an invitation to further dialogue and conversation. It's about developing the relationship. And it's, I think a decision should not be transactional. It should be relational. So I think it's not about checking a box off or putting a number in a certain part of a spreadsheet or whatever. But I think it is about looking at how together we can make the best decision and then move forward and not go back and redecide everything, but be open to when conditions change, be open to being less stubborn about sticking to that original decision.
Right. And this is where relational work, which I've used these terms on the show before, but a lot of professional work, which is contractual, is contractual because you have a limited relationship.
That's
you
have a, it's defined.
Defined. You don't get into each other's lives in complex ways.
Right, right.
But when you really work with community or with people whose lives need to change, or they want to change, they want to figure out how to engage, this is more covenantal where you have to figure out what people, you know, what each person can do on their own, because you don't want to do that for them, because that disables them, diminishes them, and you also want to do for them what isn't possible yet, because they haven't yet learned it,
right?
Or they will never learn it because they are not. It's not possible, and that is what the decision to me. That's the process of relational negotiation.
Yeah.
Is figuring out how to fit together with our unique.
I hope over time I've changed also. I was very focused on my work. I still am focused on my work, but I feel like I have a better home, family, work balance kind of situation because...
What did you have to do to make that change, to begin to make that change, and assuming that it's not perfect?
Yeah, well, perfect, that's an interesting word. I've never been tormented by the demons of perfectionism.
Good.
So I'm very, very thankful and appreciative of that. Yeah. That, you know, for me, it's about getting things done in a real, I take great pride in my work. I take pride in the work of the groups that I work with. But I realize and understand that perfection can become a demon.
Right. So let me reframe the question. How did your love of home come to balance your love of work?
Yeah.
And that's not about perfection, but that's about centering, changing how you hold the value and how you balance.
I mean, I think part of it for me, it was a natural evolution of having a certain level of accomplishment and getting older and certain level of confidence in my position and my ability. I was single.
So you don't have to prove yourself every day at the
office.
You
don't have to prove yourself every day. There's a certain, you know, exactly. There's a track record there. Early in my career, I was single. So, you know, what was home, right? And that was a question I didn't really answer very well. Now that I have a lover of, 18 years, there's a sense of home to connect with and a sense of family that wasn't there when I was single. I think other people do a better job of that when you're single than I did, of finding a place. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that it isn't ever there. I'm saying for me, I kind of didn't take care of that part of my life.
Right. And so roughly half of your adult life was not taking care of that. And the other half of your adult life has been attending to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. It sounds like a pretty typical story.
And pretty sweet. Pretty good. Yeah. Good. Yeah.
Good. What should we play next?
Well, those folks that do know me know that I love opera, and as an Italian American, I particularly like Puccini. And this is an incredible aria from Puccini's last opera, Turandot, and this is a great love story, and we're going to hear an aria by Luciano Pavarotti.
Listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And George Ferrari is our guest. So George, the way we kind of wind into the last segment of okay. the show is to kind of consider how is it that you take care of yourself emotionally, uh-huh. physically, intellectually? What do you do to restore yourself?
Uh-huh.
How do you know you need to do it throughout the day, daily, weekly, monthly? You know, how have you learned? I mean, because you've described a process of learning to love your home
yes.
and your work, but how have you learned to love yourself in yeah. the same way?
Yeah. I feel like I do that pretty well, and I'm very thankful that I pay attention to that, and I kind of feel like I've always paid attention to that. I joked before about being a stubborn Taurus. If people subscribe to or know anything about different signs of the zodiac, Tauruses are known for being... sometimes we're thought of being stubborn. I like to reframe it as consistently loyal to our own ideas. We're very loyal. We also...
I am one, so...
You know what I'm talking about. Okay. And the sign is a bull, but it really is more properly a cow. It's a female. It should be a bovine. And there's a sense of being placid, being a little slow, lazy. I like to reframe as relaxed.
Relax except when you're dug in.
relax and when you're dug in. Right. So the bull part comes out when someone gives you a red cape to wave in front of you. Then yeah. you can really, when a Taurus gets mad, and we rarely do, but when we do, run for the hills. But we also like, I think, I'm very much the kind of person that likes the sensuous things, good food to mm-hmm. a fault, soft fabrics, things like massage. Mm-hmm. So I get a massage once a month. I am absolutely overly protective of my 8 hours of sleep every day. For mm-hmm. me, sleep mm-hmm. is incredibly restorative. Yeah. I work out every single day. I find it at the end of the day a great way to deal with the stressors of the day, to move my body in a physical mm-hmm. kind of mm-hmm. way. I do attend mass on a weekly basis. That can be very helpful. I think there are ways to have downtime and relaxing time that are really important. From May through the end of September, we go camping every single weekend, and being outside, mm-hmm. being outdoors is very restorative as mm-hmm. well. So those are some of the ways in which I kind of take care of myself.
And what's really striking, and more than anybody I think I've ever interviewed, these are all ways to care for yourself physically. And the camping you do together, so that's more of a
right,
and the meals are eaten.
Meals, usually we have dinner every night together. Yeah.
So what do you do emotionally in those kind of the emotive relational dynamics?
Yeah. Well, like I mentioned, attending mass that's for me emotional and spiritual. So certainly, having. Prioritizing time together for me and my lover, to have conversations, to make sure that we don't have secrets, mm-hmm. to talk about hard, difficult things. Daniel's much more into that than I am, but once they're in it, I like it, but I will not necessarily initiate it a lot.
Right. You know how to go there. You don't necessarily lead there.
Exactly. That's a very good way. Yeah. And I'll be there if you take me there, but... and I would argue some of the physical caretaking also has an emotional component.
Oh, absolutely,
to it as well.
Absolutely. One of the things that we forget that we are emotional and physical beings, and the emotions do feed into the physical.
Oh, absolutely, and connected.
Vice versa. But a lot of people don't really talk about how they take care of themselves other than to exercise. But the fabric, when you mentioned the fabric, the sensual experience of the space that you're in.
I'm a total clothes horse. It's an awful sin that I have way too many clothes than I need, but I love every single garment that I own. Ah. And it's somewhat, that I find great joy in fine fabric and deciding what I'm going to wear every day and how I'm going to present myself
and color and texture,
color, and texture. Stuff. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
What do you do to restore your mind?
To restore my mind.
What do you do to expand your thinking or to bring new things in?
Yeah.
I mean, this is kind of along the lines of
right.
How do you, seeing yourself as kind of the George Ferrari institution, because this is when
God.
We make ourselves.
Oh, that's terrible.
But we are people. We have boundaries. We also respond to challenges.
Yeah.
How do you integrate that?
Well, I'm not as great a reader as I think I should be, or as I think that I would like to be. So it's not really through that as much. It probably is more through conversation with other people.
Yeah.
I'm sort of an overly verbal person, so it probably has to do with that.
And I would totally guess conversation.
Because
a strong introvert, that's the most likely.
I'm a strong extrovert.
I mean, strong extrovert.
One would ever, Eric, confuse me as an introvert.
No, it was just merely a brain fart on my part that I said the wrong term.
Yeah.
But no, because people who are more introverted will do the reading, and I kind of sit. I'm sitting on the middle. So
you're balanced. That's good.
Well, not necessarily balanced. that's is not a word people would apply to me. Nuance sometimes,
okay.
and articulate, but not necessarily balanced. So for me, that there's a 45 minutes to an hour in the morning where I'm reading and meditating, mostly reading the paper online, and that is my time.
Good for
and
you.
And I see stuff, and I see patterns in the news, or I think about things, or I make connections that haven't happened, and that to me is really important. I love conversation. I grew mm-hmm. up in a certain sense, you're very extroverted, but you visit. And people, this is becoming a theme in my life and my work, because we don't know how to visit with each other, because visits aren't debates.
No. And
they're also not intellectual. They're personal. They're about subjects that could be intellectual, but they dance across the boundary of the personal.
And I think visits are, when you said visits, I flash back to my grandfather on my mother's side was from Georgia. So although I don't identify as a Southerner, we certainly visited him often enough to understand the Southern culture of visiting. Right. Visiting, and it was caretaking. It was checking in. Mm-hmm. It was touching base. It wasn't small talk, as sometimes gets denigrated, but it was about, I recognize you as a person, and you recognize me, and we have a connection here. And I'm going to check in on you. You're going to check in on me.
And the one piece that I would add to that, from where I'm from, mm-hmm. is that, tell me where you've been, because I want to see the world that you've mm-hmm. seen that I have never seen and will never see.
Mm-hmm.
And the old men in the town that I grew up in,
yep.
when we would go back, they would want to hear the stories, because that's how they got the news. I mean, before there were
yes.
These were people who had become adults before there were radios.
Radios.
Uh-huh. And so they knew how to inquire.
Sure.
And so... and how to evaluate? Well, did you was there something you missed that you're not telling us, or I mean,
right.
not in a mean way.
It wasn't a debate. It wasn't challenging like that. I mean, I think often about like walking down the street in Ithaca, and people will look at you in the eye and they don't even say hello, which makes me a little crazy. I mean, because I would like to have a community where even if you see someone you don't know, you just acknowledge their existence. Hi,
right.
Have a good day, you know, that sort of thing. And there's a certain northern, northeastern kind of, I'm moving about my business on the street and I'm going to be not acknowledging other people in the same space, that I find a little awkward.
Right, and to me, this bumps up against the idea that you don't exist.
Yes.
And you don't have a right to exist.
Right. Or and the worst part, I will erase you. I have the right to erase your existence, right?
Yeah. And so when I came to Cornell from rural Midwest mm-hmm. with this very strong visiting culture, mm-hmm. even though I grew up in a rural ghetto where there's lots of violence and the older folks,
mm-hmm.
I had this quality and I knew how people were people with each other. So
yes.
when I arrived at Cornell, I said, people aren't people here.
There you go.
And I couldn't articulate it that way until many, many, many years later. But people, you only talked about the coursework. You didn't really talk about each yeah. other's lives.
It's transactional, not relational.
Exactly. Yeah. And even with peers, it was, you know, how much of a party you could have rather than how much you could really get to know each
yes.
other. You know, and it was just, it drove me crazy. And it made me feel isolated in a desert, yeah. in a relational desert. And what the reason I'm spending so much time on this particular idea is as part of the community foundation, as part of the community and nurturing mm-hmm. this community, what kinds of rituals or what kinds of things could we institutionalize that yeah. might make it possible for us to be more available to each other yeah. without crossing boundaries that we
right.
shouldn't cross,
right.
but be to demonstrate openness.
Boy, that's a huge question. I don't have any specific answer other than I think that a lot of people are hungering and thirsting for that. I
right.
think there's a
and
there's
I don't
real
expect
fertile
you to answer,
to,
but you've just said you're open to it.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I think most people are open to it, whether they're conscious of it or not.
And there's a woman in town who's tried to kind of institutionalize a gesture where you put your arm across your heart and you open it up to say that I'm able to help. Say if you've got a child that's out of control.
I didn't know that.
It's a gesture that would work in a certain kind of community, but and for certain kinds of needs,
yeah.
you know, like do you need help getting the wheelchair out of
yep,
the car
yep,
or whatever?
Yep.
And we need these kinds of communication devices, and they need to be institutionalized for the so we can rely on
interesting.
Them.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's my suggestion. If we could think about that and help us think about that
yeah.
as a community, that would be community development.
Maybe. Yeah. And that certainly would be a role and a place to have that conversation would be the Community Foundation. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, George, It's been wonderful to have you.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask, what close do you want to go to your closing song, or do you want to play the Earth, Wind, and
if
Fire?
If we only have time for one song, then people who know me know that it has to be Diana Ross. She's my muse. She's my diva. It's gotta be Miss Ross.
So tell me, unpack that. Why Diana? Why is
Diana she... throughout my life has been someone that speaks to me, and someone who has elegance and class and nerve and verve and helps us understand how we can take better care of each other, and is very, very optimistic. This last song is probably the optimistic anthem, right?
Right. No, I completely agree. What I see, you know, you may have made a mischoice in going to engineering school, but there is a sense in which there's a self-contained quality that you've described, and this being that self-contained entity from the very beginning.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. George, it's wonderful to get to know you.
Thank you so much for asking me to be on.
Just call my name. I'll be there in a hurry. On that you can depend and never worry. You'll always have me.